This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. It's a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Xin Gu about cultural work and creative subjectivity, re-centralizing the artist critique and social networks in the cultural industries. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you for having me.
This is a fascinating book. I think it's an important contribution to both the kind of creative and cultural industries, literature. There's obviously a lot of academic interest in things like cultural and creative work. But also, I think it tells us something about why the places that we live are like the way they are at the moment. And it's got lots of, I think, insightful points about kind of work and society in general. And the place to start, I suppose, is probably with the title. And it'd be good if you could give a sense of kind of like what cultural work is and what creative subjectivity is as well.
Cultural work encompasses a broad range of activities and practices involved in the creation, production, and dissemination and consumption of culture. So in this book, this term includes the work of artists, writers, musicians, filmmakers, designers, and many others who contribute to the production and circulation of culture goods and services and their experiences. So in my book, the use of the term is not so much confined within that traditional definition of artistic practices, but extends more to various forms of creative expression, culture intermediation, and knowledge production, which shape our social and culture arena. This book does not, I should say, engage explicitly with the symbolic production of creative expressions as such. Rather, I'm more interested in how contemporary culture work is deeply intertwined with economic, social, and political dynamics, reflecting broader power relationships and social inequality, and just generally struggles for these particular marginal groups of culture workers to gain recognition and representation within our neoliberal societies and beyond.
I'm interested, I guess, in the sense of how these two things come together, really, the kind of the labor of, as you say, producing culture in a very broad sense. And actually, later on, we'll probably talk about things like kind of making and craft and new forms of almost kind of industrial production. But then with this idea that runs throughout the book that you call, or I guess you kind of draw from authors that have called the artist critique. And I'm kind of fascinated by where that fits in. You know, you talked about the sense of living in a particular kind of neoliberal societies, neoliberal kind of milieu. And where does the artist critique fit in with this? Because obviously that connects quite directly to the phase of capitalism in which we find ourselves.
One key aspect highlighted in this book is just how the artist critique interrogates the romanticized notion of the artist as a kind of solitary as genius or visionary figure. Instead, the book emphasized the social embeddedness of artists and their work within broader social, economic, and culture contexts. So I very much highlighted the ways in which their work is shaped by not just individualized inspirations, but also institutional frameworks, market forces, and the power dynamics that they are embedded in. So in the book, the artist critique underscores the individual agency of artists in resisting and subverting dominant discourses and practices within culture industries. But at the same time, it explores really how artists, especially this particular group of marginalized artists and culture workers, navigate the tensions between wanting to have or preserve their creative autonomy, but have to negotiate commercial imperatives at the same time. And the way they organize or preserve that artist critique is very much through engaging in acts of culture resistance or intervention to challenge existing social culture norms and ideology. So the book really delves into the significance of this term, the artist critique, in addressing issues of social representation, diversity of culture expression, and social justice within the culture, so-called culture industries, or in some places, creative industries. The book highlights the role of artists as culture mediators and advocates for marginalized voices and perspectives, advocating for greater social inclusion and equality within creative practices and industries. And very importantly, I guess I see this as a kind of key contribution of the book, is that the concept is presented here as a very much a tool for fostering critical reflection and dialogue within the artistic and culture communities and beyond. So I listed in this book, as you mentioned before, Dave, some examples of how artists might question their own assumptions and practices and by engaging with the broader social political context in which they operate. So that cross from the neoliberal societies of different kinds. Ultimately, I think these kind of advocacy work from the arts community contributing to a more nuanced understanding of cultural work and its implication for society overall.
You've given, I suppose, some hints, or at least you've also outlined a little bit the kind of social critique that comes as a, I suppose, a kind of partner concept to the artist critique. And one of the things I was really intrigued by in the way that you frame both the artist and the social critique is the importance of places. And again, you've sort of talked a bit about this already. And I'm really interested to know why place is so kind of important in the book, and how place interacts with both the social and the artist critique that run throughout the book.
Yeah, this idea of the social critique of culture work is really quite central to this book. It refers to the examination of the broader societal implications and consequences of culture production and consumption in a contemporary sense. So the key argument in the book really is to say that if we are viewing the artistic contribution to society or that type of culture work not from a traditional artist critique lens, but through more of a social critique lens, what might that look like? So it involves questioning the ways in which cultural work intersects with their broader social structure, the power dynamics and ideologies, and assessing its impact on individuals and communities and societies as a whole. So this place, so why do place matter to the social critique? For many reasons, really. I think place provide that kind of spatial context within which cultural production unfolds, as we all know. They encompasses kind of physical locations, which we now know as creative neighborhoods, creative cities, creative regions, as well as virtual spaces and digital platforms in today's world. So the social critique really recognizes that the spatial context in which cultural work takes place really influences the forms, the content, the meaning making of the cultural work, as well as the opportunities and the constraints faced by cultural practitioners. So places are deeply connected with notions of identity and authenticity of cultural workers. They serve as a key hub for understanding or making sense of heritage, memory, tradition, and shapes people's sense of belonging. The social critique concept then unfolds around this idea of how cultural representation practices may negotiate the very complex place-based identity, history, and experiences, and how these dominant narratives may sometimes obscure or marginalize alternative voices and perspectives, which is very much the kinds of groups that I focused on in this book. I think also, as mentioned before, that places are sites where these kind of extreme social inequality and exclusion can be experienced and observed. So the book also interrogates how certain places become privileged, and the way in which these place-based identity intersects with a little bit of a class and gender issue, which I talked about in the book through some of the case studies. So yeah, so in general, I think the social critique considers the impact of contemporary culture work as it becomes increasingly in the subject of globalization. You know, that sense of the erosion of local distinctiveness and how cultural work might actually bring back some of the tension as a result of globalization. So I actually emphasize quite a bit on this idea of digital technology and mass media, how they contribute to the homogenization of cultural landscape and displacement of local culture and traditions, and how those kind of trends and factors underscores the importance of preserving and celebrating the unique quality of cultural work situated in the history of specific places.
I mean, we're going to dive into those places. But just before we do, the book also gives attention to consumers. And actually, you know, mentioning digital technology is really crucial there, but I'm fascinated to know, in a book that's, you know, its title is about work, you know, the kind of focus might be just about kind of labor and work, where consumers kind of fit in to the story.
Yeah, that's a fascinating question that I started with when I was researching the book. I brought in this concept of truth events, which is a concept out of Alain Badiou's work. And I really like his conceptualization of this truth events. I think his concept of the truth events really centers around the understanding of the rupture or the discontinuity within existing social political orders. And these events, in his theory, challenges prevailing norms and ideologies, opening up opportunities for new kinds of subjectivity and collective through collective actions. And so I very much apply that concept in trying to understand marginalized culture work. What does that mean for individual consumers who are not just producing, not just passively consuming culture products, they are also actively participating in meaning making? So I described the consumer's participation in this sense as a form of activism, as a truth event. So it, in terms of activism by consumers, these can be conceptualized as embodying the assertion of alternative truth and the mobilization of collective agency against individual, against these systems of oppression and injustice. So instead of seeing them as individual consumers, I would like to see them as a group of collective agency. So activist movements composed or driven by consumers very much, in my view, challenge the hegemonic power structures within the culture industries or the creative industries, because they are actually delivering a very important message to the industries that they demand recognition of their now marginalized voice as well, as a result of these, you know, massive global dominations of culture enterprises through their acts of resistance, protest, and solidarity. And so in my book, I really explored how individual audiences can actually engage with artists to develop these activist approaches by participating in movements. Individual consumers can confront social realities and confront their own belief and cultivate a sense of agency and empowerment. And the end result of that, really, which is quite unique in the book's argument, is to encourage individuals, consumers, to critically reflect on their own roles within broader social political context, to inspire them to challenge dominant narratives and take active ownership of their own identity and actions. So it's not so much about let's come together, make change in society per se. I very much, like Badu, actually encourage or become very hopeful that individuals, by participating in arts and culture consumption, they will be able to hopefully express their own concerns and really kind of transform their own individuality. So this is the whole process of reclaiming their creative agency over their own lives and contribute to the realization collectively of an alternative future. So yeah, it's a quite interesting concept that I was very much I enjoyed very much playing with that concept, actually.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
How does all this play out in places then? That there are sort of four substantive chapters in the second half of the book that take deep dives both into particular kind of cultural creative industries, particular kinds of cultural creative subsectors, but also really kind of grounded in place. And I guess if we start with Manchester, the Manchester chapter kind of tells the story of maybe the early years of the creative economy as we understand it in Manchester. And I think it tries to tease out the sense of how, in this case, independent fashion designers think through the tensions of being, you know, a kind of artistic cultural producer and also having to make money, being an entrepreneur, having to run a business. And I'm fascinated to kind of hear a bit about, I suppose, Manchester's experience of the early years of the creative economy.
Yeah, I started my research career really in Manchester, so I had a special relationship with the city, as you can tell. So in the very early years, I was lucky enough, I should say, that when Manchester started to develop its own, I believe, you know, one of the first creative economy development policy, I was very much part of that process in its early years of becoming a creative place. So there was a very strong sense of optimism and possibilities amongst the independent fashion designers that I worked with through my ethnographic work research with those people, many of them now almost retired from the industries. The city's culture landscape at the time in early 2000s was undergoing these rapid transformations with increasing recognition of its creative potential and growing investment, actually, I should say, from national and local government in culture infrastructures and initiatives. This early period witnessed really the emergence of vibrant creative clusters, networks, providing opportunities for creative workers, most of them are independents actually, to showcase their work and connect with like-minded peers. And I want to tell that story. You might say that happened two decades ago. Why is that relevant? That's very important because it allows us to see this fluctuation and evolution of not just the policy scene, but also that kind of hope for change and what has happened to it after that many years of policy intervention, really to understand whether policy intervention might make a change in the field. So in the case study chapter, I talked about this excitement on Manchester's creative renaissance as a creative city. The independent fashion designers grappled with that tension inherent in balancing their role as creative people, but also the city's rise as a global creative city. They were driven by this passion of creative expression and innovation, seeking to push the boundaries of traditional creative culture norms and aesthetics. They're very extremely experimental. And importantly, they have that desire to give something back to their city and create these kind of authentic creative identity, which reflects their place of belonging and being, and also reflected their personal values. But I think 10 years on, I went back to visit those designers and trying to really gauge a sense of how has the whole scene changed. And it was really interesting. I met lots of designers who then faced pressure to actually become quite fatalistic about this whole creative narrative. And they face an enormous amount of pressure to commercialize their work and to cater to a growing market demands, thanks to their own work in a way, in order to sustain their persistence in the creative sector. And this transition from artistic autonomous expression to a commercial production posed significant challenges for them to maintain their creative integrity. So as they navigate the complexity of things like pricing. How do I price a piece of garment? How do I market my fashion work? How do I distribute those to a global audience within an increasingly saturated competitive marketplace? And despite these challenges, so I talked a lot about the fatalistic, you know, the bad side of the story, I guess. And then in the end, I think through that kind of up and down, I've made up my mind that despite those challenges, I believe the creative discourse actually allowed these people who would otherwise never really be able to find their place in the creative sector to actually at least have a voice. But they do so not because they balance very well between the artistic and the commerce, but through a way of engaging with a communal sense of being. So again, going back to that Badiou's idea of the activism from the fringe, which I talked about before. So collaborative platforms and events that's created as a result of these kind of engagement really provided opportunities for these creatives to showcase their work, to access resources, to co-create resources, which were not really there if there wasn't a creative discourse. And so ultimately, I believe that on an individual level, these creatives demonstrated strong resilience and adaptability in response to the changing demand of the creative economy. There's tension between being an artist and being an entrepreneur, but they embrace that opportunity for experimentation, innovation, self-expression at the same time. They embraced a hybrid identity, which is both artistic and entrepreneurial, and they're finding new ways to negotiate that creative autonomy whilst also staying very true to their values for craftsmanship and quality of their artistic invention. So there's good and bad side of the story. I just want to add a bit more element to it and really portray the story as truthful as I can be at the time.
That idea of artistic autonomy that comes up, I guess, in the navigation between kind of the demands of business and the demands of creative or artistic activity in Manchester, plays out in Shanghai, which is the second of your case studies. But in this case, you're really focused on, I guess, kind of more formal artists and also writers as well. So how does artistic autonomy play out both for those creative workers, but also in Shanghai?
Yeah, so I was lucky enough to be part of the invention of the term creative industries in the city in Shanghai, in China. So when I started working in Shanghai, I think around 2008, the government started to put some money into developing creative industries, including developing these very expensive and very amazing creative clusters. But I really, as I did in the book, focused on the impact of those things on marginal creative workers in the city. So in this case, writers and artists, contemporary artists living and working in Shanghai, which were very much under the radar of governments in terms of policy support. So many of these people don't really registered as culture workers by the government because they don't really have a business number to operate as entrepreneur, do not work for any big or any forms of organizations or businesses. So they are very much the under the radar or the gig worker, if you like. And in this middle of a rapid urban development and globalization that the city is going through at the time. So these people have to grapple with questions of artistic autonomy with a very different kind of societal expectations that the Manchester creative workers that I interviewed before had to go through. So within that very different culture ecosystem, these creative workers confront various kind of constraints and pressure, which impacted their pursuit of artistic autonomy. And the other unique thing, as we all know about China, is that there's a strong state censorship. And so some of the works that these people are doing, especially in the writing sphere, there's a strong political sensitivity that they have to navigate. So their challenges is a lot more comparing to those people working in Manchester, I would say, which often limit their ability to express their creative autonomy. And so they must negotiate between artistic integrity, the commercial market demands, but also the political side of things. So their experience, really reflects a delicate balance between the state, the market, and the individual, which is another dimension I explored in the book. So they engaged with, to my surprise, actually, initially, I think they were very kind of active in engaging with commercial opportunities and leverage those opportunities to deal with the political pressure. And they also seek different avenues for creative expressions which resonate with broader societal currents and culture trends at the time in the transforming Chinese society. And they the key strategy for this group of artists and culture workers is really in that category of subversion and resistance to assert their autonomy and challenge prevailing culture norms. And they use both direct and indirect critique of government. They navigate different boundaries of censorship and carved out really a unique space for alternative perspectives within that cultural landscape. And thanks to those kind of strategies, they were able to create a very kind of diverse and interesting creative space for the city. And also, just to add to the local context, Shanghai, as we all know, is a very influential global culture city nowadays. So its status as a global metropolis really exposes these people to diverse influences and transnational exchanges, which shape their creative practice and worldviews. And so the book actually really draws inspiration from that transnational intermediating role that these creative workers play by, engaging with international artistic movements and participating in cross-culture dialogues. And as a result, they become really the defining voice in terms of what a creative industry discourse might look like for the city, although that defining voice very quickly become marginalized as China grapple with its own political reality of the creative cities policy, which I talked about in the later chapters.
Yeah, we might come to that, particularly as we sort of wrap up. But before then, it'd be good to hear the Melbourne story for two reasons, really. One is because this sense of creative subjectivity runs, through the story in Melbourne. But I think perhaps most interestingly, in the Melbourne chapter, you're dealing with, I suppose, a kind of an emerging type of culture and creative work, people that are, I guess we'd call them makers now, but they sit at the kind of intersection of artistic craft and industrial production. And it's fascinating in the Melbourne chapter to get the sense of who those people are, as well as kind of how Melbourne matters as one of these kind of global creative cities. So what's the story of the makers in Melbourne?
Yeah, the makers in Melbourne refer to this very diverse group of artisans, designers and craftspeople who engage in creative production across diverse domains, such as textile making, fashion, manufacturing, furniture making, and even digital fabrication. So people using 3D printer machines to make a piece of furniture, that kind of thing. So these makers embody what I see a very strong spirit of craftsmanship, which has been discussed first by Richard Sennett in his book of the same name. And I'm really kind of fascinated by this question of what's wrong with doing some job well, and what's that kind of ethical, moral commitment to the quality of work could contribute to the development or extension of this quest for creative subjectivity. So I studied this particular group of makers in Melbourne, just trying to get a sense of, you know, what are the factors to compel them to actually become creatives. And makers in Melbourne, the book actually engaged with mostly with their hands-on craftsmanship as a central aspect of their creative practice. So they prioritize these material aspects of their production, investing huge amounts of time and their personal skills training into the creation of these artisanal goods, which reflect their individual aesthetic sensibility and their technical expertise. And their experimental approach to their work, for me, really explored or extended this idea of the creative subjectivity, because it also allows us to understand that these types of new material, new technique, and new forms, which will give them a strong sense of place, authenticity, and identity to the place where they work. Because a lot of their work takes place within these vibrant creative precincts, their shared studios, and then the collaborative workshops, which foster a strong sense of community and collective identity amongst these makers. So the one of the fascinating story is that the makers of jewelry makers, they could actually locate outside of the city, but they all chose to be in this particular creative precinct in the inner city. And the very reason for that is so that they could form this little community of creativity, allows them to share that collaborative social exchange and mutual support. So I think the example of Melbourne really make us to think about, you know, what will a creative precinct look like? What is a creative ecosystem? And what does creativity really entails? And it draws inspiration from Melbourne City's rich kind of culture heritage, and also its dynamic urban landscape. And it allows urban planners, policymakers, really to think about the role a city's history, architecture, and social dynamics plays in relation to the creative practices within the sector. And also, I think Melbourne's makers showcases a very unique type of creative entrepreneurial spirit, seeking to turn their creative passion into viable livelihoods. They navigate this very complex market settings and develop these sustainable business models. And they are actually leveraging, you know, digital platforms and social media to engage with their audience and their customer locally and globally. So this also reflects a desire to not only create, you know, beautiful culture objects, but also to make a meaningful impact within the broader society. So yeah, it's definitely a new element which has often been overlooked by the culture work literature.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So You want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
The final substantive chapter, I guess, extends that focus on digital methods and the idea of culture and creative work having a almost kind of, you know, global market and global possibilities. It compares the kind of present day Manchester with present day China and has this focus on digital workers. I was fascinated by the idea of deprofessionalization as a kind of key term that was happening in Manchester, but maybe was experienced quite differently in Shenzhen, in China. So what's the, I guess, kind of comparison doing in that chapter between Manchester and China and the focus on digital workers?
The digital workers in Manchester really just grapple with the effect of this process of deprofessionalization. It doesn't happen overnight. It's over a long period of time, which including a period of declining job security, diminishing wage protection, wage levels, and also increased precarity in the digital employment situation. So the traditional notion of employment and professional identity, as this traditional notion of employment and professional identity kind of erode, workers in new media, digital media sectors, they face heightened competition, outsourcing, and more recently, automation, which undermines their bargaining power in the market, labor market, and their ability to really negotiate favorable working conditions for themselves. So this word deprofessionalization really just referred to that precarity and insecurity amongst digital workers in Manchester as they navigate a gig economy environment, and very much characterized by short-term contracts, project-based work, and fluctuating demand for their services. And many workers, they experience income volatility, irregular hours, and very limited access to benefits such as healthcare, retirement savings, and or maternity leave, which really affected their financial stability in the medium longer term, and eventually their sense of well-being. A significant amount of these people in the Manchester case were freelancers or self-employed entrepreneurs who face additional challenges associated with managing their own businesses and marketing their services in a highly competitive marketplace. They must juggle multiple roles as creators, managers, and marketers, but also dealing with other more managerial tasks such as client relations and financial management, which can be time-consuming and emotionally draining. In contrast, I think, so there's a lot of kind of, depressing working conditions going on in Manchester. And there are contrasts that with the experience of gig workers, digital gig workers in Shenzhen, a major technology hub in China known for its booming electronics and vibrant startup culture. So I think both cities are becoming or have been promoted by their state to become centers for digital innovation and entrepreneurship. The social economic contexts and the labor dynamics, on the other hand, differ quite significantly between the two cities. So in Shenzhen, the digital workers contend with a very hyper competitive environment, rapid technological change, and state-driven initiatives to promote these sectors and their innovations. And despite facing similar kind of deprofessionalization pressures and precarity, digital workers in Shenzhen, they benefit from greater state support, access to capital, and opportunity for career advancement within China's rapidly evolving digital economy. So that allows us to be thinking about what can policy really do, you know, to actually make sure that these conditions are met and people can continue doing these work without feeling the whole sector is being dismantled somehow by market forces. But ultimately, I think the experiences of digital workers in Manchester and Shenzhen really reflect broader trends of globalization and technological changes, which shapes the contour of work and employment globally. So as these new technologies continue to transform nature of culture labor and culture production, workers in these both cities and globally must adapt to new forms of employment, and they must train themselves to upgrade their digital skills at their own cost, and navigate very uncertain and rapidly evolving digital economy.
That, I guess, is one of the kind of key ongoing issues for a sense of kind of worker subjectivity. And the book, I think, does a really great job, actually, of showing the experience of, on the one hand, potential, but also precarity. I think we've covered a sort of great range of themes that are in the book and ideas as well. But obviously there's kind of so much more that we could have talked about. And it strikes me that the book is the kind of text that might set really a bit of an agenda, both theoretically with the various ideas of critique, but also empirically in terms of maybe doing more place-based, city-based case studies. So I'm intrigued to know where you're going next, and I guess, are you going to kind of continue the agenda set by the book, or have you moved on to something quite distinctive and different?
I actually moved on. I moved on, but only a tiny bit. I've decided to work on a project which is called Media Culture Policy. So I think based on this book, I became really interested or intrigued by this profound impact of technological advancements in shaping the creative economy and culture landscape. More specifically, I think I would like to explore a bit more how culture policymakers must leverage these new technological shifts and challenges to foster innovation, social inclusivity, and sustainability within the culture sector in years to come, whilst also, you know, addressing some of the basic culture policy parameters. And I'm also particularly interested in exploring the evolving dynamics of audience participation, as I mentioned before, about consumer as activists, digital through digital storytelling or other forms of interactive media experiences, as well as exploring strategies for enhancing digital literacy, promoting culture diversity, and fostering connections between creators, audiences, and culture institutions. So in a nutshell, I would really like to understand how culture workers in the margin might be able to stimulate dialogue, foster collaborations, and catalyze positive changes within the culture sector by addressing opportunities and challenges posed by technological advancements. Thank you.